Songwriter Soup.
That third year, that fourth year that, you know, athletes get it together, it's very similar for songwriters where they're like, I'm constantly hungover. You know, like maybe I shouldn't be constantly hungover.
Healthy recipes for not losing your mind and your money in the songwriter business.
I do think of us being vessels, and it's like, if you can't, if there's something holding you back from letting this flow through, we're not going to get there.
Presented by American Songwriter. Hey, y'all. Welcome to Songwriter Soup. This is episode 9?
10. No, 9.
9.
You're right.
Who knows?
Trust the producer.
Yes.
This is episode 9. We've covered a lot of ground, and we haven't even gotten a deal yet.
Oh, my God.
Thank you. As a songwriter.
But you're stuck
all
with
that's
us,
about
people.
To change, because now we know somebody in the business. We are honored to welcome Mr. Mike Molinar to the podcast.
Yes.
Yay. I'm honored to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you for coming. Laura, why don't you introduce Mike?
I would love to. Mike is my treasured publisher. We've been working together since the beginning of my journey with like actually getting, you know, paid to write songs. It really began with us over a conversation. We were at a dinner. We just found ourselves kind of scooching closer and closer together and ended up in deep conversation about, I don't even know what, but it was very passionate. I don't know. It was impassioned and emblazoned.
Hard to believe with Laura Veltz in the room.
Oh, my. But I think it was one of those things where it's like, are we going to? And then we met the next day and it felt very magical and cool. And yeah, at the time you were writer managing with Martha Earls.
Oh yeah, I remember.
Yeah,
that time,
and I was getting tired of waiting tables and bartending. So this was that moment. What do you remember? I remember it like very vividly, but I've told my version of that like 50 times, probably even on this podcast. What is your memory of that?
You're correct in that we were sent out to a writer's round, or asked to go to a writer's round to go check out a artist writer band and see if we were interested. And actually it was my Scott Borchetta, who is involved and been a big part of my journey of the last 11 years. But we were not officially in business yet, but we did have a working relationship with a joint venture, and so he said, if you know, go check this out, if it's something you want to do, we'll figure it out, we'll fund it and you guys can work it. So we went out that night and there was a writer's round, and then we went to dinner and I had a songwriter who was with me, one of my hit songwriters. And we end up at dinner again, just as you said, scooching closer, kind of. And there's just it's a bizarre thing. It's not only just the universe, you know, trying to bring people together, but, you know, I've said this a lot. One of the odd things when you're sitting with a songwriter is you're not just listening to their songs, you're listening to their history. You're listening to, you know, have they had an opportunity to build a musical vocabulary? Have they performed? Have they put in those 10,000 hours? And in their actual speech, you can hear rhythm of the words, you know, in their emotions, you can hear a certain level of empathy or humanity that you think is going to plug into songs. And so you can start to crystallize, like, does this person get it before you've even heard their music? And I don't know that I was consciously thinking that in the moment or breaking that down in the moment with Laura, but it was certainly like, you are checking a lot of boxes right now. Like you know, there's a lot of things going on here. And as she said, we finally got to the point where we were sitting next to each other at the table, at the dinner table. And I was like, what are you doing tomorrow morning? You know, can you go have coffee? Cause I want to know more about you. And that's what came out of that dinner, which is also why you show up in this business. You know, you don't know why you're there. And oftentimes it's not the reason that you thought you were. And it's actually become a practice where when I go out to a show, or I go out at night, or I go to a party, or I go to something, I try to come home and really think about, like, why was I there? What was the thing that I, you know, saw, or who was the person that I met? And Frequently, I write something down on my phone so I don't forget it and just be like, let's go follow up on this. And you just get that instinct.
What's super cool for me on my end of that is that, you know, songwriters are very wired to be like, what feels good? What feels good? And that just like very simply was like a feel good moment for me. I'm like, this person feels like my people. I'm really fucking lucky, because what if you were just a really nice guy?
Like, complete.
That could have happened. But lucky for me, like you had to whatever you were, you know, sensing about my language, I think your empathy about how to handle creatives was subliminally evident to me. And so that I just, you know, thank the universe for that sort of energetic bond. And because it's, I mean, we're still working together. That was like 12 years ago.
12 years ago.
Yep. And I have no intention of not working with Mike, and the family of people that he's built around him are just, they're all bleeding the same Mike energy. Everyone has the same energy. And so for that, I'm just so, so grateful.
The phrase that pops into mind listening to both of you is that you publish like a manager. Like it makes so much sense that you met when you were writer managing, because to me, in my interactions with you, you think more like a manager than a numbers crunching publisher. And I think a lot of great publishers do that, but that is a special thing.
You know, I owe that to songwriters who taught me how to think that way along the way. And I remember being challenged at one point by a songwriter who was constantly challenging. but, you know, I was in a part of my career where I was really accepting that challenge to grow and to try to be more and try to be better. And, you know, that some of us think about this job in just a receiving songs and pitching songs. And, you know, yes, this job has morphed where when I first started out, we didn't do writer calendars. We didn't set up every single write. We made some introductions, but a writer really kept their own calendar. Now, you know, that's a big part of what we do and the value of what we do. But that in-between space was, could you create opportunities for your writer? Could you put them at that, you know, at that party? Could you make that introduction?
The connector, yeah.
You know, and that writer was really challenging me to put him in more situations of those introductions that he needed. And he was absolutely right in doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think he really was, you know, one of the first to just get me on that track. And once I was on that track, I just continued to explore it. And then, you know, through the years, you start to learn that all of the different ways that people are educating themselves about songwriters. And so, you know, it's the town has a way of bringing songwriters around, and it's this circular thing, and you keep going up levels and levels, but some of that can happen naturally, but there's things that can also be influenced. So a lot of it is, you know, word of mouth on the street, but there's certainly, you know, third party press or third party endorsements and live performances at the right thing at the right moment with the right song. So there's things along the way that I figured out how to, I don't want to manufacture sounds way too sterile, but it's, you know, it is create an environment.
Facilitate.
Yeah, facilitate. Mm-hmm. That's a better word. But, you know, and you just we're waiting for a writer to reach that point that we can help them with each of those steps. And, you know, one of my favorite things to do is I generally write our writers' bios. And when you start from the beginning, and there's no cuts, right? Or it's like, you know, they're co-writing with, you know,
yeah.
It's like, and then you get to start adding in, you know, cut by cut as it happens. And then you get into like, oh, they have a superstar cut that I can put at the front. And then, oh, they have a hit that I can put at the front of that bio. Or now they're multi-genre and we can use that word, or they have awards, or they have Grammy nominations. And so, you know, I've been with Laura long enough where we've, you know, the bio, writing her bio, and every time we come back to it is so satisfying and enjoying to look at this 4-time, you know, Grammy nominee, the first woman to be at number one on the Billboard Country Songwriters chart. You know, it's just things like that are historic. It's amazing to watch her career. And while we may have facilitated and literally just cracked the door open, she's kicked it down, both with her person and with her talent. So that's
so freaking wow.
So, speaking of bios, before we get too far down the road, we introduced you, Mike Molinar, the person. We know your name.
We blew right past what you do for a living.
And we have mentioned...
That's what liner notes are for.
Big Machine, but just for the folks at home who may be a little bit lost, can you give us just the nitty, like the top level, what is your job? Who are you? And just so we know who we're listening to.
Sure. So I'm Mike Molinar. I have been a music publisher for 26, about to be 27 years in the capacity from being an intern to a catalog manager to a song plugger, all the way up to owning several independents. As Laura mentioned, I had two boutique companies. The second one, we were, on a shoestring budget, so we did anything to just make it by and continue to working with creatives. And then for the last coming up on 11 years, I've been at Big Machine Music, which I started at the request of Scott Borchetta to get into publishing for real. And we started with a handful of copyrights, and we're now at almost what will be 50 number ones here shortly, maybe by the time this airs. I think we're about 14, almost 15,000 copyrights.
Wow. That's amazing. Nuts. And I just not to gloss, I just don't want to gloss over this too much. The way that you were describing your first interaction with Laura and sort of where your mind goes when you're evaluating the readiness or the utility, the usefulness, the longevity perhaps of a potential signee, is that the right language? Songwriter. Sure. Was like, I got this, like, I was awash with like romantical feelings about it. It was like, oh, this is extremely human, because at the end of the day, what we're all like, what the goal of music is, especially in Nashville, is describing the human experience in a way that hopefully feels, like we talked about last episode, somewhat universal.
Can I add to
please?
That? I feel like there are publishers in town who do some version of what Mike does, but I do feel like there's a little bit of like saltwater, freshwater with like creatives and people who do business around creatives. And my favorite publishers are like brackish water in the middle, where it's literally like you can figure out how to live in both waters. And the way that Mike speaks to me, I remember I heard someone say something recently. A publisher was saying, oh yeah, he writes for me. Just the wording of that. And I bristled just listening to the way that sounds for the writer's sake, because that's not true. As much as you want to call that true, that's absolutely not true. It's a partnership, and that's an ideal situation is when you're partnering with a publisher, but it's very easy for a publisher to see creatives as minions. It's very easy for creatives to see publishers as minions. Mm-hmm. And I think both of those scenarios are not productive. And they certainly don't give that magical feeling that I get, you know, still just knowing like, oh, wow, I feel so housed. You know what I mean? I feel so held. Like I feel understood, and I get to go do what I do best. And he knows how to make sure that that best is still coming, you know, still coming out of me. And that to me is like ideal. I don't think that's how everybody does it on both ends.
Well, you can see though, how when you approach, approaching the business with the mindset that Mike described, can still be very successful, and perhaps more successful in the long run because of the values that you impose on, like, the criteria that you're using to evaluate a person's, you know, worthiness to be a part of the organization or whatever.
Even the story of us meeting, you know, Laura and I meeting underlines advocate is the word that comes to mind with great publishers like what you do is, you know, anything to enhance that songwriter's career is top of mind. In our conversations, that's been a big component.
And Mike and Tracy have been friends for longer, have been working together for longer. And we've said this before, but Mike was seeing like financial stuff happen to me, sensed my anxiety and introduced me to Tracy. So that's a great example of just how full spectrum I think a publisher can be, you know. And it is a really nice blend for a creative person to have that full spectrum sort of overseeing. Parenting is too strong a word, but something like it. Like, I understand you know.
Shepherding,
whatever it is, like a big picture. So yeah, I really value the way he does it. And I hope, same reason, I hope, you know, there's more Tracys in the world for financial advisors. I really do hope there are more Mikes in the world for the publishing community for the sake of creativity.
Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah. We like you.
That's the last time that's going to awesome. Happen. Now you're in the hot seat, bud.
I will say that, and this isn't in any way a disparagement of my friend at the majors, but one of the things that I'm blessed to have is a lot of autonomy. And I've been only an independent music publisher my entire career. So I've never worked at a larger company. This is the largest company now that I've ever worked at, because we've been acquired twice. And so we're now part of an international global
fancy
company. and honestly, a lot of days, you know, to keep myself grounded and happy, I just think about as being a small independent music publishing company. And that's where I find my happiness. And that's where I find my effectiveness. But, you know, I had at the point that we started Big Machine, had experience at similarly situated companies that was really beneficial, and we were successful, and it was familial, and had the benefit of amazing mentors who showed me how to do this. I also worked with people who showed me how not to do this, and then when I went out on my own because I thought I was a hotshot at 30, at the tender age of 30, and got my ass kicked, and realized, you know, I was doing everything alongside my partner, Martha Earls, and we were in charge of all aspects, and it was good for me to learn hands-on all the aspects. But between all of those experiences, by the time we got to Big Machine, I understood a lot better of how to structure this and what was important to start with and what could be put, you know, further back in the line. And it also was one of those things where I had the benefit of deciding who I wanted to sign. And so we kind of have this no asshole rule. We have this, you know, no dead men walking. Like, you know, we don't want somebody who's going to be coming in and just looking at us, and we're not passionate about them, and they're not passionate about us, and we're like, we're passing each other in the hallways. You know, I just hate that, and so that's allowed us to develop a theory of the way we were going to work, and that's just this tip of the spear talent, fewer songwriters that could cover more areas, and if we gushed and you know, into them and really, you know, super served those people, we could do more and we could be more effective. And that's, you know, just like anything, that's our strategy. It's just like sports. That's the strategy that we've, you know, we've general managed our writing roster to be. And it's why we've been successful. When we when we start to not be as successful, usually we check it against that. And we can immediately see in our own actions and our own intentions how we've gotten away from that. And we have to come back to that center of it.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful for us. Just hearing that, I want to bring attention to the fact that we've had two other writer publishers on this podcast who've done interviews, like Jimmy Robbins and Luke Laird. And that whole passing in the hallway is a running theme. Like, knowing that you dig the people that are in your, you know, dwelling is a top of mind, high priority. And that just makes me feel good about the future, because I've been signed to a major and I've been signed to a minor. Not a minor. What's the other word?
Indie.
an indie. And I feel that. I can feel the difference in that. I feel like a product. I felt like a product. I felt like, felt not good somehow. That familial feeling. Yeah, I just, to anyone's listening, who is listening, if you can find that familial feeling at a major, yay, go do that. But I think it's that feeling that is important to seek out, you know, just feeling like you're a part of something important and that you're being served properly.
I don't have to sign anybody for market share. I don't have to build market share. I don't have to, you know, think of it that way. I can just decide that this person is going to be, is currently or going to be a hit songwriter and has the longevity to make it through the cycles. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I am interested in longevity. And this will dovetail into this conversation. Like when, as we structure our make offers, you know, our immediate thought is how do we stay in business with this person long enough to get them through the first cycle? And then where are we, you know, where does this deal finish? And is it a point that we know how to continue the relationship in a second deal? So, you know, the second deal is already in my mind as I'm structuring the first deal, because I want to be able to flow that in and build it in. And so we're, and not only just for my own purposes, but also where the writer feels growth in their career and feels respect via that, you know, both agreements. And I think, you know, already listening to some of your prior episodes, I think, what happens, you know, to disturb, I'm big about like the natural order of things and the real flow that things that can happen. But when bidding wars happen on young talent and, you know, it destroys the natural order of things. It really hurts a writer in the long term more than it helps them because their expectations are out of whack and that, you know, they're not allowed the same amount of space to grow and create. And, you know, while their balance is getting heavy and usually they're out of that first deal, you know, anyone who's usually in a bidding war right off the bat is usually out of that first deal a lot quicker than
going to another place,
mm-hmm. you know, rather than, you know, somebody who's kind of getting nurtured the right way along the way. And it's, you know, even as you get into this first deal, the odds are very, you know, it's tough to get a deal, right? And then when you do, it's there's just a pretty good odds that you're not going to make it in that first deal, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's just not going to hit. That doesn't mean you suck. It just means, you know, you're learning the ropes and you're figuring things out. And then, you know, usually in that second deal, that's where things start to kind of take off.
And that's a numbers thing, I imagine. You're just looking at the average writer. You know, the people, huge hit songwriters, future Hall of Famers on their first deal, that's not when to expect a number one. It's not when to expect a number one.
Well, that was Luke Laird's story.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't even think he was going to get a second deal.
Yeah.
I knew Luke back then. I mean, I've known Luke and Jimmy, who you've had on, and we I love hearing them, you know, tell their story because I was there. I'm old enough to have seen it and been there. And I remember when Luke wrote Painless on the Leanne Womack album. And it's when, you know, like that song was just so great. And it was like, yes, mm-hmm. there you go. And then he started to, you know, we're very friendly with both. And we used to go on vacations with Luke and Beth. And I think even when they were dating, and Luke would always start beatboxing, you know, he's yes. always joking around. But that rhythm thing, it really became a part of his writing. And I can also attest to both, you know, the work ethic of both him and Jimmy. On vacation, Luke is up at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. and he had his earphones on and his beatbox and was doing tracks or working on things or journaling. And I'm a pretty early riser, and I was the second one up every morning because he was already beating me up and working, just getting ideas out of his head on vacation. And it's a testament to why he's been successful.
I want to come back to something you said earlier about your first deal. You may not have that hit, and you may not continue with that company, but it doesn't mean you suck. Mm-hmm. Tell me what does that writer look like? I don't mean physically, but what does that deal, you know what, I'm trying to ask, like, if I'm in that deal and I'm thinking I suck because my deal's not going to extend, but I don't suck, what does that, who am I in that space? Sure. What have you seen?
You know, I think there are so many analogies to other things out there, and especially sports, but or college even, you know, it's like it takes you a couple years to realize where the cafeteria is on campus and where the, you know, the, yes, where the bathrooms that you like or any of those, you know, it's like where the library is. It's just, you know, that comfortability of habits of, you know, it's such a change to go from whatever you were doing prior, whether it's the, you know, the shitty jobs that you guys have talked about, or if you're a student at Belmont, to realize that you now have to show up, you know, probably 3 to 5 days a week and write songs, and you need ideas that are fresh, and you're trying to be competitive against the very best songwriters in the world. So, you know, the day that you were signed, you were now on the field against Tom Brady. You know,
man, come
on. Intense.
You know, wow. you're on the field against Ashley Gourley,
yeah,
and Jesse Frazier and Laura Veltz and Jesse Joe Dillon and Ryan Hurd. I mean, you are on the field with the very best. And so, how are you gonna bring it? What do you bring to the party that's going to, you know, that's going to be competitive, if that's the way you want to think about it? And I think, you know, when we put a jersey on you, you know, that's a big deal. And we're saying, like, hey, you are already good enough. You've got something that is you that you just need to bring. And I think the strongest thing that writer needs to realize that they can bring is ideas, because the vets have the musculature. Oof. They know what to do. They can see the field. But what the young writers need to come in with is just the raw of their experience and of their relationships or of their friends' relationships or the way they see the world. And especially if music is changing, then, you know, what was their influence? What are the beats? What's the rhythm? What's the asymmetrical part to the verses that they're going to, like, but this is the way so-and-so's doing it now. You know, like, the other thing too is in your early years as a writer, you're so, in your head. So you're either analyzing about what you're bringing, and it's like, ooh, am I bringing enough? Am I saying too much? Am I doing this? I don't want to. And the relational aspect to these co-writers as you're being introduced, or you're kind of in a third person watching it all go down, and
you're not in your body,
and you're not in the song. You're not driving down the song. And when you see a you know, all-star, all-pro, Super Bowl quarterback, you know, on the field, they're just not even thinking. Like, they've already embodied they've run this play so many times, they already know it, and they know where everybody's going to be and what the spots are going to be. And so they can concentrate on being in the moment to just see that. And, you know, the writers just aren't on the page. They're not in the song yet.
Nor should they be. Like, they're learning.
And, okay.
I think that the writers, especially, I'm guessing, like, I'm imagining my little self listening to this. I just moved to town. And of course, no matter what you're saying, I can hear my own head saying, you're going to beat the system. You're going to be the exception. You're going to know all the rules immediately. You know, it's just such a temptation, because that's who we are. But, like, this is really good information, because your ability to go kind of sit back and be like, oh, I don't have to be a veteran, could really make the process more enjoyable for you as the new person.
Absolutely. I mean, I have two things to that. One, I was actually driving in and I was thinking about this exact thing that, you know, I am an insufferable asshole who believes he is always an exception to the rule. And I work with insufferable assholes.
Truth.
Who all think that they are exceptions to the rule.
That's
and that is why we make magic a lot. It's also why we terrorize ourselves a lot, and why we get so unhappy with things around us when we can't make it move. I am so unhappy when I can't figure out how to do it. On the flip side, I, you know, my method of doing that is generally, and Laura and I connect on this as humanity, you know, like,
yes.
I try to empathize with where somebody is. I see what they need. I know what I need. I try to go into that realm where we both get what we need and make everybody's life better. But, yes, so I agree with it. And you are the exception if you get here and you get the deal, because it's just like the NFL. You just got drafted. You made one of those teams. The odds of you making those numbers is it's really hard to do that. And then just like sports, you know, it's tough to have a longer career. It's tougher to be an all-star. It's tougher to win a Super Bowl, you know, all of those things. So you're just, it's all of these funnels that get smaller. And it's amazing and should be celebrated for every one of those steps that you make or don't make. And there's no wrong answer. If you're in and you're making, and you're part of this community, you are in. Congratulations. You should celebrate that. There is this sweet kid, this writer who we looked at a couple of years ago, and I saw him on Sunday at the Sounds game, and he was sitting there on the berm and talking to his friends about a write where he was in with a veteran writer where he felt like he got schooled. You know, he just was blown away by the skills of this writer who took his idea and just drove it down. And the fact that it's a Sunday and it's, you know, beautiful day, and he's there with his girlfriend and two friends and watching a baseball game, and this kid is still talking about how, you know, he's reliving this write. Like, that's just the passion and that you want to see in a songwriter who's trying to get better and is recognizing everybody's skills and appreciating it, and not beating himself up for not being better, but just celebrating that he was in the room and has this opportunity to learn. And that kid's
fucking love songwriters.
He's gonna do things, you know. And I look forward to being his second or third publisher, you know, somewhere down the road, because it's I feel that from him, you know. I felt like, again, he's one of those deals that it got out of control and it went somewhere else. And the great thing I can say about, and I can really say this definitively, we've never missed a deal that we should have had now at Big Machine. Like when we miss it, it's for a reason. And I actually am always happy that, you know, the deal felt, it just feels unnatural. Mm-hmm. Something felt unnatural about the timing of it. And on the flip side, three of the songwriters that we signed last year, we looked at other times for their first deals, and for various reasons, we either didn't do it or they didn't do it. And as they came around the second time, we were, it was the time, you know, the timing was right and everything was right. And all of them are off to the races, you know. In 6 months, I think we have about like 15 cuts within the three of them, which is crazy, you know, to just be immediately plugged in and in. So timing is a lot of things, and it is a thing to celebrate this first deal if you get in there and you have this opportunity.
It's a good time to talk about the first deal.
Yes.
Or shitty deal.
We call it shitty, and I know there are different perspectives. Yeah. The reason we call it shitty is not because it's shitty according to a publisher. We call it shitty because a writer thinks it's their big break, and when they realize that the numbers are not quite something, they realize later that, wow, I signed something crappy. And we're calling it shitty so that they understand what they're signing right off the bat. And we went
and to challenge the term. I mean, I think to say that, yeah, it's a shitty deal, but there's a reason. The publisher is taking financial risk, running your calendar, but then, so take that. Publisher's taking a risk, but also you don't work for the publisher. This is a big theme that you've already brought out, that you don't work for the publisher. You're partnering, and you should have certain expectations, even as a young recruit.
Well, but before we let Mike defend himself here, can we just outline what we think? Like, we're describing a shitty deal as if we all know exactly what those terms, but like, what are terms in your opinion that are shitty?
I think that we should break down what you're getting, mm-hmm. and what you're giving really the gist of every deal is getting in exchange for what you're giving. And if we could just walk through those things, that would be probably 1,000 light bulbs to a ton of people. also people who are fully in the business who have no idea what they gave away or what they should have been getting. Like I, you know, and I think that those things are important to understand. So,
I mean, why don't we talk terms first?
Yeah, yeah. Let's assess before we assess the quality of a deal.
Yes. In the what are the terms?
And what everything means. What is the deal? Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Sure. I mean, so likely a writer is signing up for an initial period of a year. And if we're talking what goes on in Nashville, so we're talking a Nashville-based deal versus a pop deal. But, you know, it's usually a 1 plus 3, each those numbers representing, you know, contract years. So a 1 year plus 3 option years. And the publisher can either pick up or not pick up each of those option years.
So the word option means... the publisher's option.
Has the option.
So you're signing a deal for 1 year, but you're looped in for potentially 3 years if the publisher wants to keep you. Just want that to be clear.
Or is it four?
Three or four.
Oh, okay. Depending so on how many option years.
It's three, so three one or, plus three one or plus one three. Plus two.
Right. Right.
Cool. So that's the term. What about the money?
Yes. So the way I look at the money, and it's obviously changes with you know, especially in this city with cost of living and other factors. But, you know, I basically don't want you to work a second deal as much as possible. You might have another little bit of an income
second
source.
Second deal. Sorry. Explain what you mean
not a second deal. I don't want you to work a second job.
Right.
So, you know, if I can get you out of that waitressing job or that other job, you know, that would be great. Maybe you have a little bit of other income. Maybe it's a, you know, especially because Nashville is home to so many churches that, you know, if you're making a little money from being part of the music ministry, or you are, if you're a producer writer and you're doing some side projects, or if you're, you know, playing some gigs and making
doing
some
demo
cash,
vocals,
doing demo vocals, you know, there anything like that, like, you know, maybe there's stuff around there that you help pick up a little cash. I also will try to bring some things to you, like corporate gigs that, you know, wherever possible, just to help you get a little bit more jingle jangle, you know, to assist. But basically the money that I'm offering is like, hey, you can live on this, you know, but you're not going to live high on the hog. You're just going to live on this. And so, and that's the way I, you know, the minimum amount is that what I'm trying to do is think about being in business with you for that year plus the 3 years. I want to be in business with you for 4 years so that it gives us the time and the space to, you know, nurture your career and get there before crossing over some lines, some financial lines where we're going to be in trouble. And I'm going to have to drop you. So I don't want to do that. I want to be able to stay in business with you as long as possible. That's the way I'm thinking for the sake of development. And if you think about it this way, and again, take any kind of business, we're not like a clothing store or a restaurant that we can go and buy inventory and we can start selling that inventory. We have to build inventory,
make
inventory day after day after day. And again, as part of the numbers game, you know, you're talking about probably 1/10 of your output at that point being viable, where we need a lot to be able to have those handful of songs that are really going to be as competitive and potentially a hit. You know, it used to be that numbers game for me, like of whatever your catalog was, probably 10% should be on hold and 10% of that will end up getting cut. And then we'll just start to see where the singles fall. And that's, you know, it's been challenged. I don't know if that's as quite as accurate as it used to be, but that's at least what I'm looking for. So I really need you to write a lot. I really need in those early days, because we got to build that inventory up. And it also helps, you know, the musculature and the mind and us in conversation to help steer you to go, yeah, okay, what you're doing there, that's great. And it's like, oh, I can feel you're not, you know, this doesn't feel like in your wheelhouse. Let's kind of go this direction, or, you know, and we just, it allows us that opportunity to have a lot of feedback. The
and
more
time,
you write, and the length of time. So the money is important so that I can stay in business with you.
Yeah.
You
know? And so just to underline it, you're hitting so many powerful points.
Totally.
Underline one thing that stood out to me: 1 in 10 songs is even competitive.
And let's define competitive. Competitive meaning I can pitch it today and it'll get cut today. Competitive meaning it's a great song that's ahead of its time. Like that might not come back to you until later. So I think those numbers are not immediate either. So there's a really weird sliding scale of what 1 in 10 really means. It just means you wrote a great song that might take 10 years to get cut, you know? So the odds of it, and then like Mike said, a 1/10 of that might end up, you know.
Yeah, just on hold just means somebody says, I'm kind of interested right. in it. Yeah, I might right. cut it.
And you have to recognize that in that first deal, the goal isn't necessarily every day. Yes, we want that product every day, but we're making a lot of introductions for you. And so as we talk about, you know, what the trade-off is, you know, we're putting you in rooms with a lot of people and who we, it's either for skill development. We talk about a lot the chocolate and the peanut butter. Like we're trying to find who is, you know, who or what is the category of writers that can best complement your skill set. So, you know, part of this is for them, for the writer, part of it's for me to try to figure out, you know, what can you do and what do you need help with? So especially, you know, even when someone is incredibly overwhelmingly talented, where they are a vocalist and a great musician and a great top liner and have everything, well, immediately I know you probably need an editor because you're so brilliant that you are spewing, you know, shit out of your mouth and you need a butterfly catcher to go, yeah, okay, that, or also just keep you, you know, from rewriting it again, that's wow. my big pet peeve. Mm-hmm. It's like when someone's brilliant and they're like, man, I don't think we have it. I think we need to go back to the first. It's like, no, we've got it. So having that person in the room to catch them. So I'm always looking at who's going to complement and all of those introductions. So some of the rights, you know, it's first dates. First dates are tough, you know? So do I expect to have the highest quality songs right out of the gate? I don't. If I'm trying to make sure that I want to create relationships. I want to have good experiences for you. I want to have learning experiences for us so that we can figure out where you're going.
And fine tune. Like something that we talk about a lot in the book is about calendar management. And your calendar is equal parts the publisher's responsibility and your responsibility. So if you don't like the week you're having, feedback is important.
Feedback's very
If
important.
You don't like the rights you're in, feedback is important. Oh, that first date season is all about getting into a deeper partnership with the people who handle your calendar. And I think that is a huge blank spot on pro songwriters. I've had conversations with people who are just like, well, I mean, it's on there. I guess I got to go and do it again. And I hate it. And I'm like, why? I don't know why you think you're working for them like they're employing you. And I think part of the problem is that you're waiting tables and you're writing your little poems and you're trying to get, you know, the thing to happen. And as soon as someone offers you any money to do that, it feels like an employer. Like right, just to the mind, to a writer's mind, it feels like someone's paying me to write songs. And I think that makes you a little calendar shy. It makes you shy about giving feedback. And I think that'll be something we cover a ton, I think, over the course of the entire podcast's life, because it's a tough one.
Yeah. And initially, trust in the publisher, I think, too. There's the feedback, but also you're trying to get those first dates to test drive it mm-hmm. and build that community we talked about previously of
exactly.
Like who's going to work.
Right. And it's getting, you know, the first thing I'm trying to do even more than just have the songs that I'm going to pitch is, can I get a comp of songs that show who you are and what your skill set is and that we're going to be really proud of putting in front of people to go up the next level. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to build that first comp. So that first four songs, maybe, you know, that when I start putting you in front of people and they listen to it, they're like, yeah, I get it, you know? And generally speaking, like I'm really lucky. I have a reputation for working with a certain level of writer, regardless of whether it's first deal or second deal or pro writer. And so if they're with me, generally I get I'm using my leverage for these songwriters to be able to get them into the room. But I like to be able to show both the songwriter that I'm working with and the town. It's like, this is who you are. This is your handshake. Mm-hmm. And you don't, you know, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. And so, you know, I'm trying to micromanage that first impression really, really well. And because that is going to lead to the speed, that is going to make a difference in the speed down the road. So I'd rather be slow in the way we do this first step and get it right so that it will move us along faster as we show who you are and the quality of your work.
And that leverage is worth something. Your leverage
it
to
is.
Get into
it.
So
it is. So let's go back to the deal.
Yeah, let's talk. So let's talk about the money side.
We talked
yeah.
about you know money being you know it's not going to be. You're not significant. I love that. I remember when Laura was signing her first deal and she was like, yeah, I'm not expensive, but I still want to be able to eat at a nice restaurant once in a while. You know? So, you know, we kind of,
great negotiator.
Like, yeah.
I was like, okay, was like that was, yeah, that was basically her line. I don't know if you remember that.
But I don't, I which do. Is amazing. I love it.
And, you know, and the publishing ownership is probably one of the biggest things.
Yeah, we need to talk about what writer's share is, what publisher share is, what those two things look like on a first deal specifically, because we'll get to the set, we'll get later, but typically, just a quick question for you, and maybe we should just define what those things are. I have an analogy in the book that says that the writer's share is like a pizza. When you start having activity, you get to eat the pizza first because it goes directly to you. The publisher's share is like a pie, a cherry pie. It's something you will enjoy later. And but the fact that if you don't know the cherry pie exists while you're so distracted and excited about the pizza pie, you're going to be mad that no one told you how valuable the cherry pie actually is. And so I think this is the one of the biggest misunderstandings. I don't think there's anyone I've talked to that didn't, like, nobody had this really fully understood when they were signing their first deal, that a publisher share, the cherry pie, is the only way you pay down your draw. The money that the publisher gives you doesn't get paid back until you own a part of that publisher share.
Well, even
sure, it's. I think I'm
go to the top.
It's yeah. a. This is yeah, tricky. So this is going to take a bit.
It is tricky, and it's you know it's unnecessarily complicated for whoever first started this as a right.
But, yes.
Inherent to a each writer's share of any song is 100% of a publisher's share and 100% of a writer's share. And, you know, in almost every deal, you're going to be maintaining your writer share income, but that income will be in exchange for the advance that you're receiving, you're assigning that income to recoup your advance. So, you know, to your publisher, you're also assigning your publisher share to them as their earnings or as their asset. So, you know, what you're assigning your publisher share to me in 100% of that in a baby deal, in a first deal. And again, part of that is the level of leverage and risk and everything that we're taking. And we're going to advance you money and we're going to recoup that money from your writer share. If at any point you get a piece of the publisher share, then we also recoup from that. And the writer share, we never recoup from your writer performances, so your radio money. So that's still going to go to your mailbox and that's still going to be your income stream, but all of your non-performance share is going to go into this recoupment.
Okay.
Can I summarize
yeah.
some things?
Yeah, please
and
do.
You stop me if I miss it, okay? Because I'm just a financial dude. I don't know every ins and out. Radio plays a song.
Yes.
It earns a dollar.
Yep.
That dollar rolls down, and this is just radio. Maybe some streaming too creates a performance revenue.
Right.
Okay. Then that performance revenue gets split writer share, publisher share. And what you're talking about is that, so that's 50 cents.
Sure.
Is it even
sure.
generally?
Yes.
So public performance comes down, revenue, it gets split. There's 100% writer share, which gets paid through BMI, ASCAP, CSAC, PROs.
PROs to the writer.
Directly to the writer.
And that's split between whoever wrote
whoever the writers
the song.
Are.
Yeah.
So if you're a three-way write, we
get
all
a
get
third
a third.
Of that.
The publisher share, which is that 50 cents that comes down, typically in that baby deal, that goes 100% to the publisher.
Correct.
So
now, 100% split into threes. I know this is complicated, but it's important for the person to hear.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's also split into threes.
Into threes.
So, however many people wrote it, If you wrote a song with three people, the writer's share gets split into three. If the total people in the room who wrote the song are three people, the writer's share gets split into threes and the publisher share gets split into threes. Wanted that to be clear. And all of the publishers who are on those writers, you know, books or whatever, it goes to them.
So 1/6 of this equation is going in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
1/6 of this is going in the publishers.
That's if there's
if it's a three-way ride.
If there are three writers in the room. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is pretty typical.
Yeah.
So then on the baby deal, if I don't have what we call co-pub, which means I'm not sharing as the writer, I'm not sharing in the publishing, that's going all to the publisher. And the draw that you're paying me, my little draw that we won't call a salary because it's a draw because you're a business owner. I love that you call it draw, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I call how I pay myself.
Yeah.
It's a draw because you're a business owner. That draw then doesn't really ever get recouped, meaning you're not taking that out of my writer's share.
Correct.
To then pay you back. You're taking the risk. You're paying me my draw and you're getting the publishing.
Right.
Versus if I had co-pub, co-publishing, meaning I might split with Mike half of that published,
half of that
1/6,
right.
So 1/12, I get 1/12, Mike recoups my draw before I get a penny from the publisher. So demo cost, what else is there? Draw, that's the only two things I know.
Maybe travel.
Travel, yeah.
So wait, to the writer, it's a very complicated. We're going to continue, just if you're out there going, what the fuck are you talking about? We will continue to talk about this over the course of, eons. But for today, I just want this to be clear. It's not a shitty deal. It's a perfectly normal deal. But the thing, it's the misunderstanding that makes it shitty. So understanding that you still owe them money if you don't own any of your publishing is just a nice sort of earmarked thing.
That's
remember
why
that.
I love the way you approach the initial deal and how committed you are, Mike, to grow in that writer, because that you're in your mind, I think you're earning that public. I'm working
absolutely
for that publishing,
I mean,
and you're
is,
probably trying to get them to co-pub.
Yeah,
I bet.
I don't think of this as a shitty deal at all.
No, it isn't. I get it too.
And I honestly think that this is the, because I see the amount of risk that we take. And
yes.
And this isn't fair to an individual writer per se, but in order for me to stay in business and in order for me to continue to take chances, and the numbers are not in my favor. Their numbers are not on someone who's betting on an aggregate of number of songwriters. The numbers are not in my favor, which means I'm going to continue to lose
yes.
on a number of them. And then I need to win. When I win, I need to win significantly to make sure that I can stay in business and I can continue to operate.
And develop people.
And develop people and keep taking those shots and keep taking those chances. And that's also another way that I look at this, where it's like, look, I have these wonderful songwriters who are being successful in these deals. Do I really want to leverage what I'm, it's like going to Vegas. Do I really want to take these winnings and go put it over
right.
here? Because in the early days when we started this company, my current company, we were pretty small in our roster. And one of our first hits was 100%er, Maddie and Tay and Aaron Scherr's Girl in a Country Song. And those earnings for us, because we had three songwriters, significant, like baby deals, and that those earnings for us gave us a platform to come for the next 2 years. It gave me income that I could now use towards my overhead for the next 2 years and make more bets, take more bets and sign more people. And
I love hearing your version, your perspective of the exact same. It's crazy. I mean, I love that we call it shitty, because I think it's important that the writer understands that it's not going to be the same deal they sign on their second go round. But I completely love knowing that the publisher's version of this is really high risk. And in order to, there's writers right now that are going, man, I want to get signed by Mike Molinar. He sounds like a beast. This is going to be great. In their heads, they're going, I just want to get signed. But in order for you to sign them, you have to make money on the people that are already on your roster, like to I don't know. I just think that's sort of important. It's important to understand this is an entire ecosystem. Everyone's trying to win. Now, not all publishers are cool. And like we've already talked with someone who had like fucking five hits in their first deal. And that's not okay just to continue to make money on someone who should have paid you back by then. And then you've got the Luke Laird version where it's like someone said, we want to give you some publishing because this feels fair. Those are really different scenarios. And I feel like publishers have a lot to learn from this. Writers have a lot to learn from this. Like there's a way to do this so that everybody wins. But I think not to quote, you know, the great Auntie Mame, but knowledge is power. If you know what you're signing, you are more powerful. And I find in my community, so few people know what they're signing. And that to me is like the problem I'm trying to fix with this podcast.
Back to the expectations.
Yes.
Well, and you also have to understand like all of the way I described the strategy for my company is my company's strategy. And that is not everybody's strategy. Truth. You know, majors have decades worth of catalog and income coming in from that. So, you know, I have 11 years now. When I started, I had nothing.
Right.
But, you know, they have that basis of income that they can, you know, put back into the advances. They are usually going to, you know, have advance offers that are larger than mine. But, you know, those writers who were thinking about development, who think they need development, who want to be part of this system are going to come to me and take the, you know, more moderate deal. I'm not chintzing anybody. I'm just doing the best that we can at that point, knowing that this is that I'm looking at this with longevity versus, you know, a major's probably just going to give them more money, get them in the house and mm-hmm. see what happens.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily that, you know, that same mindset. I'm not bashing them. That's they can take more risk than I can.
But from the songwriter's perspective, you know, be careful out there because the offering high money is basically putting a huge red flag up a couple years later saying, drop me if you haven't recouped or if you haven't like made progress in that first couple years, you're going to look like a big thing, like to the bean counters in a bigger company, which aren't in the people business. It's going to be like, why this person hasn't paid anything back? We should fucking get drunk and get rid of them. Like getting that option to get picked up and all that stuff. It is something to consider. There's a lot of people who just take the bigger deal because in their head, the finish line is signing the deal. That is not true. And the higher the money, doesn't mean the better the deal, in this situation.
It also just depends, you know, again, every situation is going to be different, but it also just depends on what you have going in your ecosystem. And, you know, another thing, another mistake that I see, I don't even want to call it a mistake. I think one of the situations that I see is if somebody does have something going and they get lucky, they have a hit on somebody that just came to town or some cuts. And so they do have something to offer in their first deal. And they don't feel like they need the publisher's leverage quite as much. And I will, you know, my viewpoint is that you still need my leverage.
Hell yeah.
You know, because you've started the fire, but now I'm going to move it down the road and I'm going to do some things. It gives me, your activity allows me to give you more of an advance or give you better terms. But still, you know, you don't want to be known as that one trick pony that just came in with this artist. You want to have somebody who's not letting you be typecast and is spreading the gospel of your career,
right,
and your talent, and bringing it down the road. But I do frequently see somebody go like, I don't need you. Like,
yeah.
I got it. And, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I respect it if somebody thinks like
totally.
They got it. Then, you know, then keep on moving.
It's a little lonelier though. I'll say like, if you're here to build a community, whether you're, you know, the lone wolf or not, and it is a lot easier in the low points of your career to walk around a hallway where everyone still believes in you. If you're the only one in that hallway and you've got to depend on your belief in yourself all by yourself, that can be really dizzying. So I think the whole team part of this is a big part of the thing we're trying to, you know, put into the water as a consideration. Like having a team and having that feeling of synergy really affects your songwriting. It really affects my songwriting. Synergy, people who believe in me even in my lows, that's why you sign a deal.
And another, I imagine you walk around with just a catalog of Laura, here's what she does really well in a room. Here's what Luke Laird does really well. Here's what so-and-so does. Like that knowledge that you spend most of your day thinking about, I would imagine. Me as a new songwriter could never get there.
Right.
I could never meet all those people. And trying to put that glue together is really a big part of your work.
Absolutely. And in the partnership of the writer, of my writer-publisher relationship, one of the things that we do for each other is that, you know, we did this a lot. I would shoot her a synopsis of the writer she was going to be with and what I thought their superpower was in the room, what she should be looking for, if there was any personality quirks so she didn't take it personally in the room.
Super helpful.
So she knew going in that, you know, hey, this guy might do this, you know, he might say this, or they're really good at this. So she could look for that and prepare herself emotionally for whatever was coming that day. On the flip side.
And now I'm on recon because, like, oh, was that what you were going to say?
On the flip side, she tells me what the superpowers are of people that she's writing with. And
in order to match
them with...
So you've
got all these writers.
Yeah, so I can help him match his baby writers with the right people, or writers in general, all of us. Like, we're all giving... or at least I love it because it gives us a sort of, I don't know, a real, like... linear way to look at a room, like the writing room. And it makes me happy because then I think of Sarah Davis or someone who is like such an incredible talent. And then if I give feedback, then he can go, oh, that's not going to jive with Sarah in this one way. Oh, she's going to really love that. And so it's this beautiful little, again, it's like a community and it's
awesome.
Beautiful.
Can I just say, this is, we're way deep in it and I'm just fascinated by all the aspects outside of the writing room that are part of this career as a songwriter. Like what you're describing right now is like, forgive the term, but like elder statesman or like
veteran.
Thank you. Mm. That's a great word. But someone who's been around and seen some things, and the kinds of trust that you gain and the ways that you contribute outside of just the writing room to the bigger picture is freaking fascinating to me. And it just goes to show how much deeper this thing goes than probably a lot of people realize, which is why we should continue this conversation.
Yeah, for sure.
At a later date. Mike, we would love to have you back.
Absolutely.
To talk more about, you know, the ins and outs.
There's so much to this.
The legacy aspect of that. I just want to note, have this somewhere. But the legacy aspect of what you're doing together to impact the young writers. Holy moly.
Let me add this to the fun of that stew before we call it. Mike and I are friends. What's happening to the world finds its way into every conversation we're having too. Like, we have tenured friendship. So what I'm writing, I mean, we've just had some recent conversations where what I'm writing is being affected by our conversations about life and because we're friends. I wish this for every writer in town to have the kind of relationship with their publisher where that partnership doesn't just extend to this sort of mapping of how to find the right co-writer, how to manage your calendar, or how to, you know, get yourself to a part where you have publishing share. So you can, like, all of that's all there and it's beautiful, but it just goes so beyond that. Life is happening to all of us all the time. And songwriters are so powerful in that they set a tone for how people live their lives. The little things. I mean, it's so overly romantic, but this is so how I see our little job. The fact that I've found somebody who sees the world the same way I see the world, and our conversations make their way into our songs all the time. I've written songs for Mike. Like, there are things that, like, big time, like songs where I'm like, wow, Mike is a very hardworking person. And sometimes I'll, like, I don't know, send him, like, it's like a little love note of, like, it's okay, you know? And I, like,
relax.
Exactly. But, like, I think about how many.
That's when she wrote Let It Go. No.
That would be amazing. No. No, but the whole feeling of just, we're all living, we're all being, we're all unusual and unique and all the same exact fucking thing at the same time. And man, I hope writers just realize the power that they have just in the human experience part of writing songs. And don't know.
I think I'm going to flip that. And I think this could be useful. There might be a spot for this in this episode. But our job, too, is to go clear the street for our riders, and especially the baby riders. It's like we're street sweeping. So it's like, okay, let's not, I could see where you might get in trouble over here. I could see where this might get you. And that includes themselves. And that includes themselves, you know, emotionally and physically and financially. And so again, that's where you want to give them that same longevity like you need to get here. If you think about, again, going back to the athlete all-star, you see this a lot. Like the players get in, they have 2 years or two years usually. And then on that third year, they come back in monster shape for training camp, right? Because they figured it out. Like they do, if they eat better, if they, you know, in the off season, if they train a little harder, they're a little bit more focused. That third year, that fourth year that, you know, athletes get it together. It's very similar for songwriters where they're like, I'm constantly hungover, you know, like maybe I shouldn't be constantly hungover. Or it's like, hey, where are you still generating ideas? Where are you getting that from? You know, should you be setting aside that time and thought, or journaling, or movies, or more music? And you know, you start to find what's the inspirational well. How do you take care of yourself to be a vessel and be prepared to find those ideas and listen to people? So all those things start to line up, and similarly, you know, that financial stress is there, and we're trying to assist with financial stress, and we're trying to get that out of the way, because you just can't, you know, if you can't, I do think of us being vessels, and it's like, if there's something holding you back from letting this flow through, we're not going to get there. And I mean, songwriters are like athletes where there is a physical, emotional, you know, thing. There's just, if they get blocked, they can't do their job, you know, and they can't do their job at that level. So
that's exactly why we're fucking doing this, because
that is, like, the reason.
The conversation Tracy and I had initially about this book and this podcast was, man, people are really scared, and money troubles so many, and then it's blossomed into this, and I'm so, like, blessed by what you just said, because I do feel like we are trying to help. It's awesome.
That's the mission. You just stated the mission.
Yeah. Well, awesome.
Amazing.
Well, thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, guys.
This has been hugely educational for me, and I thought I knew some of this stuff. turns out I really don't.
Well, I mean, we're all learning. I feel like I just woke up to 55 other thoughts about all of this as well. So
100%. We have a lot. There's so much that we have yet to dig into, even just what you said in the last 30 seconds.
I know. Like, yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, we gotta dig in.
Let's just make sure you come back.
Yeah, we'll have hair and makeup next time. It'll be awesome.
Perfect. Good news, I probably won't have any hair by that point. I'll be a lot cheaper. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, that's it. Thank y'all so much for listening. Thank you to Mike Molinar, our guest. I hope y'all learned something today. Thank you to Luke Dick for providing our theme music. Please rate, subscribe, tell a friend. Thank you to American Songwriter. We'll see you next week.